You'll know.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'll set the levels real quick. All right. This is Sarah Milligan with the Kentucky Oral History Commission. I'm interviewing Mark Needham. He's a special assistant to the Kentucky governor. And is it actually on BRAC, or is it just for the Kentucky Commission on Military Affairs?
No, I have two roles. One is the special assistant for the governor,
okay,
for base realignment.
Okay.
And then I'm also the executive director of the Kentucky Commission on Military Affairs.
Oh, so those were, okay.
Those are separate roles.
That's what, yeah. I read them and I thought, this is two, or is
it? Yeah, there was two people doing it when I was first hired.
Oh, you and the rest of state government.
Yeah, it's okay.
Our world. Tony Curtis is always also here with us during the interview, so we'll hear him pipe in periodically. Today is July 28th, thanks, 2010. We're at the Kentucky Historical Society, and we're going to be talking a little bit about Mark's military career in general, but specifically around the time when he was at Fort Knox, in charge of Fort Knox, and his role since retiring from the military. So, just to get started, just a little bit about your history. Where were you from? How did you get into the military? Just a little bit of background.
Yeah, I was born in New Jersey, 1960. I was born in North New Jersey. I lived in around North New Jersey and towns around there. But we moved north to North Jersey when I was about 10. And I decided to go to West Point. I was accepted to some other universities and colleges, but my parents didn't really have the money to send me anywhere, and I didn't feel like doing college loans. So mm-hmm. West Point's a paid-for education, so I applied for it and accepted to West Point. I graduated from there in 1982 and entered as an armor officer. So my first, besides going to a couple of schools, airborne school and those kind of schools, I went to Fort Knox for training. And so that was in 1982. I was there from about August to December. Much different post back then in 1982 as it is today.
What was the difference?
No, there was a lot more troops. You had the 194th Armored Brigade that was there. It was a happening post. I mean, there was Armor Engineer Board was there. There were a lot more futures and experimentation, let's say, and the schoolhouse was huge. I mean, the Army at the time was probably over 750,000 in the Army compared to 500 and something today. Mm-hmm. And so you had a lot more troops training there, going to armor units, and there were a lot more armor units. So it was a busy place. And but I left there, went to a series of assignments, but of course, like all armor officers, you come back to Fort Knox for training every once in a while, and I arrived back in 1986 for more training. And nothing much had changed. I mean, it's about the same. The 194th Armored Brigade was still there, a lot of training going on. I was there for about 6 months in 1986, from January through June of 1986. I remember watching the Challenger's disaster when I first got there. Mm-hmm. And then, again, I went through a series of assignments and ended up coming back to Fort Knox to command a battalion in 2000. I commanded the 1st Battalion of the 81st Armor in Fort Knox. It was an armor training battalion, training tankers, mechanics, and Marines on armor systems and, you know, how to be a tanker.
Yeah.
And that lasted for 2 years, and I left, and I really thought I would never come back. When I had Knox in my rearview mirror, I thought, this will be my last assignment at Fort Knox. I know there's no way I'll be coming back here, but just because I've done everything you really could do at Fort Knox, I thought. In 2004, I was selected for colonel and promoted in 2000, and then I was selected for brigade command, an 06 level, colonel level command. And lo and behold, it was the garrison at Fort Knox. So I left my assignment in 2004. I was at Norfolk, the Norfolk Naval Base at the Joint Forces Staff College teaching there. And I left to go to the Army War College because they want all 06 level commanders to have completed the War College. So I went to War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And while I was there in my final month of May, really about the final month was May of 2005, the BRAC announcement was made. And somebody in the class showed me, hey, look, Fort Knox, you're commanding at Fort Knox, right? I said, yeah. And they said, well, it's being realigned. I said, what do you mean? Armor's going to Fort Benning, Georgia. You're kidding me. I was shocked that Armor was going to leave, but I understood why Armor was going to leave and go down there. But in its place were a whole bunch of other things that were coming in. I really didn't understand the scope of it. So I graduated from the Army War College and reported to Fort Knox, and this was about a month after the announcement that Fort Knox was going to be realigned. And when I got there, my replacement said, well, you know, it's really all yours on how to do this. And I really thought at the time that they had a plan for how this growth was going to come in, where it was going to go, how things were going to be built, where everybody, you know, what buildings were going to be reused for what, and all of that. When I arrived, I had to do another course. I had to go to a garrison commander's course, which lasted 30 days. And that was in July of 2005.
Was that in Kentucky?
It was in, no, it was in Virginia. It was at Fort Belvoir, Virginia. So I was gone for about 30 days. I came back the beginning of August, first week in August. And at that time when I came back, they notified me that much of the Army staff, the Army senior staff, general officers, senior colonels, were going to be coming to Fort Knox to hear our plan on how we were going to do base realignment, where it was going to go, and how we were going to affect the changes. And so I had just gotten back, so I asked the staff, what's the plan? And really, literally, they all looked at me and said, I thought you knew. And so we spent the next 2 weeks really coming up with the plan that redesigned Fort Knox. And I thought that was the most interesting part, was that literally in just a few hours, we took a map of Fort Knox, drew big circles, and said, this is going to be where all the tactical units are going. This is going to be the office park area now. This is going to be the administrative district. And this is going to be the shopping district. And this is going to be housing. And literally, we built the city in a few hours just by drawing circles on a map. And lo and behold, if you go there today, that's exactly how it worked out. We really plotted things and built them. And, you know, some of the stories going into it, and I think the key here is for Fort Knox, it was almost a major flush of the population. What was there present in 2005 when BRAC was announced, almost all of it is leaving, going somewhere. And in its place, not only is the population demographics different, but more is coming in. So in the end, you're going from a city that's the sixth largest in Kentucky, you're maintaining about the sixth largest, but you're growing by about 5,000 permanent people coming in. That's split pretty well between military and civilians. And also the civilians that are there are not really an industrial-based workforce. It's a knowledge-based workforce. Most of them have bachelor's degrees. A lot of them have master's degrees and higher. And so it was a real shift in the way Fort Knox would do business. The training was going to leave and in its place. The units could leave. Of course, the Armor Center is leaving with its two brigade-sized units, the 16th Cavalry Regiment and the 194th Armored Training Brigade. We're leaving, going to Fort Benning. The basic training's mission is going to leave. The advanced individual training mission is going to leave. The one-station unit training for cavalry and armor is going to leave. The non-commissioned officer academy is going to leave. And all the officer courses, the officer basic course, the officer career, captain's career course, all of those are leaving, going to Fort Benning, Georgia. In its place, we have now at Fort Knox a deployable infantry brigade combat team, the kind you hear about at Afghanistan. In fact, this brigade is training right now as we speak to go to Afghanistan later this year. The brigade is around 3,600 people, and they're deployable. They'll stay here. They'll be here about a year, a little over a year by the time they leave, and they're going to deploy for a year, and they'll come back. But that's different for Fort Knox. We haven't had a deployable unit there since the mid-90s when the 194th was actually dismantled during a BRAC round. They were deactivated. So that's one, a brigade of 3,600 soldiers. You also have now there the 3rd Expeditionary Sustainment Command, commanded by a brigadier general. And that was used to be the 3rd COSCOM in Germany. BRAC had them move from Germany back to the United States. Also, two reserve units, the 84th Army Reserve Readiness Training Command out of Fort McCoy is moving to Fort Knox, and as well as the 100th Division out of Louisville. It's a reserve division, training division, moving from Louisville to Fort Knox. But I think some of the biggest changes are in what the Army calls Accessions Command. Accessions Command is the command responsible for cadet command, officer, candidate school, training NCOs to be officers, and also recruiting command is underneath them. Mm-hmm. All of those commands will now be at Fort Knox under Accessions Command. So Accessions Command, commanded by a 3-star general, recruiting command was already at Fort Knox, and cadet command is moving. Cadet command and Accessions Command were at Fort Monroe. And perhaps the biggest command, the one everybody knows the most, is Human Resources Command. That's a command of, let's just say it's somewhere greater than 3,000 people, mostly civilian, probably about 800 military and the rest civilian. that will be moving to Fort Knox from three different locations: Alexandria, Virginia, St. Louis, Missouri, and Indianapolis, Indiana. And they'll be converging on Fort Knox, and they're really they're doing a conversion as we speak. That command is absolutely huge. It's the largest human resource firm in the world.
What do you have to do in preparation to have people move from those locations to a place, I mean, like Fort Knox? It seems like they're very different demographically.
Yeah, it is. You know, the basic training mission, for instance, the soldiers live in open bay barracks and gang latrines, not unlike what you see in Gomer Pyle or, you know, one of those shows back then. So can you imagine putting a bunch of high-paid civilians into those things? And I don't think they would survive too well. So, one of the cute stories that came out of this was when BRAC was studied and announced, there had been some research on how much money it would take to move these commands. Mm-hmm. And in the study, it determined that it would take a total of $17,000 to move Human Resources Command here to Fort Knox. And I remember talking to the commander of Human Resources Command at the time, was Major General Rhett Hernandez. And I said, "Sir, you know how much money they're giving me to move you to Fort Knox?" He goes, "No." I said, $17,000. He goes, "What?" I said, "Yes, sir, that would buy you a front door with your name on it. That's about it." I said, so we have some work to do to figure out how we're going to do this. And the Army determined they could probably move into the existing infrastructure of Fort Knox. Well, that proved not to be, because the units at Fort Knox couldn't move to Fort Benning until the infrastructure was built at Fort Benning. So we couldn't move them into existing infrastructure. It was already occupied and would be occupied till the end. So we had to go through and make a case to the Army. And sure enough, they gave us around $200 million to build a building, which, by the way, turns out to be now, it is now, the largest office building in Kentucky. It's 1/6 the size of the Pentagon. It's over 883,000 square foot. 4,400 people work in that building every day. That's larger than the population of Robertson County. Wow. That'll work in that building every day.
Wow.
And that's how we got it. That's how we got that building built. And that is now part of that office park area I talked about when we drew the big circles on the map. The Infantry Brigade Combat Team is now part of the tactical area. And their build-out cost over $250 million. In fact, from 2005 until probably next year, when most of the BRAC spending will be done, it'll be close to $1 billion worth of construction and infrastructure going into Fort Knox. Just truly amazing how that ended up happening. And it is, and when you look at that infrastructure, for instance, that building I'm talking about, the 883,000 square foot building, 70% of the materials for that building came from within 100 miles of Fort Knox. So if you talk about a boom to the local economy, and at times, we had well over 1,000 contractors working like ants building things on Fort Knox. The Infantry Brigade was about $250 million build-out to put their facilities up. Their barracks, command facilities, and company operations centers were all put up. And so there was a lot of work to be done. One was just planning and master planning where to go, but then there was a lot of work by the Corps of Engineers and the garrison staff. And I was the garrison commander, which is really, the garrison commander is kind of like the mayor of the installation. You kind of run the installation. What's different about the mayor, or my job as a garrison commander than a regular mayor, is not only do you have responsibility for the infrastructure, the water, sewer, the roads, and all that, but you own all the buildings. You own all the housing, you own all the restaurants, you own all the office space. All that belongs to the garrison commander, and he's responsible to maintain and take care of it, as well as provide information technology services, provide law enforcement, fire, emergency services. All of that goes underneath the garrison commander. Morale, welfare, and recreation, all the restaurants, golf courses, and a lot of it all belongs to that command. So we really had the opportunity to redesign how we did business. And if you look at some of the other things that had to be done, when you move this many people in there, you can imagine other systems are affected. And the easy ones to look at and see are the roads. Okay, you know there's going to be some roads busier. When you put a brigade of 3,600 soldiers in an area, you know you got to do some expansion of the roads. Same thing with a building of 4,400 people coming in and out. You know there had to be some expansion of roads. That's easy. What we'll also have to look at is schools. These soldiers come with families. And so you have to make sure the families are cared for. And a lot of the families live off post. And we had many meetings between myself and the school superintendents off the installation in probably an 8-county area letting them know when and where, how these students would come in and what the numbers were looking like. And we were able to actually predict, I don't know how close we're going to get, but we gave them figures on how many kindergartners, how many first graders were projected. We had certain statistics that led us to those conclusions on what we'd have. And so we formed transition plans on how we transition these students, where they would go, how we would get the information to them on what school districts were available to them. And, you know, all of that had to be thought of. But then there were some little things you think of that, wow, do we really need to take care of this? If you look at the health and family services, social services, you had to look at that. You had to look at domestic violence. Would that increase? How would that go? Other social services. Mm-hmm. We had to start looking at healthcare and what kind of services there would we need. Was the OBGYN clinic big enough? Was the orthopedic clinic, was it staffed at the proper size? And we started looking at the infrastructure, the water, the sewer projects that needed to be done to support the growth. We looked at airfield. The garrison commander owns the airfield as well, and the airport. Had to look at that and what needed to be done there. Another thing was housing. Housing on post belonged to the Army up until 2007 when we privatized our housing, and I was there to do the privatization. We partnered with a company called Actis Lend Lease to form a limited liability corporation. Mm-hmm. And a limited liability corporation called Knox Hills actually took over the housing. They now own the housing on Fort Knox. It was about 3,000 homes that we turned over to them. What this allowed us to do was to use that money from the homes, the residual value of those homes, and also the income from a basic allowance for housing that a soldier gets every month to live in quarters. You take that and you go to banks and you negotiate a deal, and we were able to negotiate about $220 million worth of money from Bank of America to rebuild the housing on Fort Knox. So at the same time we're doing all this other construction, we are actually rebuilding the housing on Fort Knox. So we're going from about actually less housing on Fort Knox. There's 3,000 now, going to go down to 2,500 because there was a lot of inadequate housing on Fort Knox that just needed to be torn down. It was old. You couldn't repair it. It had to come down. But that's okay, because the community outside the gate had built some adequate and affordable housing that could be used. However, I will tell you right now, as it stands, the rental market at Fort Knox and the surrounding area is saturated. There are no rentals available in the Hardin County area. I mean, you might catch a couple, but I'm telling you, there's not many. There's still some homes for sale, but the homes are going fast, and that's just the way this growth is. In the end, the total growth, according to Paul Coombs, the University of Louisville, will be about 7,800 people, not including family members. We include family members, as well over 14,000 will move into the area because of this BRAC. In a population, Hardin County is slightly under 100,000. That's a significant growth in a very short period of time. It's much greater than Toyota. As far as the monetary value, $322 million in increased payroll from those 7,800 new workers to bring the payroll of Fort Knox well over $1 billion a year. 40% increase in tax receipts from the region as well. So it's a terrific boom to the economy, terrific boom to everybody here.
How did all this end up moving to Fort Knox? Why not some other place?
Well, that's a great question. The Armor Center moved to Fort Benning because that was the home of infantry. And they've always wanted, they've thought about that for many years, putting the infantry and armor together, because they always train together. We always train together with infantry, so why not be at the same place? That kind of made sense. Mm-hmm. But when they looked at Fort Knox, they said, you know, I told you about the study that was done in preparation for BRAC. During that study, it showed that Fort Knox had the 12th highest military value of all the installations. It was greater than Fort Campbell and many other installations you hear about. There were some that were bigger, mostly because of size. Fort Bliss was rated very high value because it has over 1 million acres together with White Sands. National Training Center at Fort Irwin, California was rated high, but Fort Knox was rated right up there. And you're wondering why. Why is Fort Knox that rated that high in military value? Well, part of it is its acreage. It's got 109,000 acres, and a lot of that is maneuver acres in which you can send units out to maneuver in and do their training. But another piece is its non-encroached acres. In other words, there's not a lot of housing areas built around it and encroaching upon its business and interfering with training. You know, when you have tanks shooting, they make a lot of noise. And if you had large housing areas right next to the installation, I'm sure you get complaints from landowners. And so we don't have that. In fact, the people of Kentucky kind of welcome those booms. A lot of them would call that the sound of freedom. And I relax when I hear that I know training's going on and, you know, all is okay when I hear those booms. So those unencroached acres mean a lot. But also, the infrastructure on Fort Knox was in pretty good shape. A lot of it was built in the 1930s. It was a work's progress out of the New Deal from President Roosevelt. And believe it or not, that 1930s infrastructure, I'll tell you, I'd put it up against the 1950s and 60s infrastructure. I think it's better. Wow. You can take it down to the bricks and renovate it, and it's very well done. Another thing about Fort Knox that makes it strong is its energy program. It's probably the most energy-efficient installation in the Army. Not many people know that. Almost all the, all the summer load, all the summer gas requirement is done from wells on Fort Knox. Fort Knox drilled its own natural gas wells and pumps its own natural gas. Pretty soon they hope to have enough to do the winter load as well. But and the other part is geothermal. They drill into the earth and put wells down there for heating and cooling. The temperature of the ground 500 foot down below is pretty constant. And in the summertime, you can pump heat into that cold. In the wintertime, you can draw heat out of it. So well over 50% of the office space is under geothermal. Some of the biggest geothermal energy projects in the federal government are at Fort Knox.
When did that happen?
It happened a lot when I was there, and my predecessor really started the process of conversion and doing that. And really, it's as simple as you take out a mortgage on the project, and you pay off the mortgage with the energy savings. So it's an energy, it's an ESIP, energy savings, ESCP, and I forget what the C is, or a UESC, utility energy savings contract. And you end up doing these contracts where the organizations fund. For us, it was a rural electric cooperative that funded the bill for this, mm-hmm. and also train equipment for heating and cooling. They actually installed the equipment and said they'd accept the savings from it. So what we found out was we were actually paying off the systems faster than we thought, so we took the extra money and invested it in more, and it kept on snowballing.
Is this becoming common across the board at other installations?
It's becoming common across the Department of Defense, Air Force, Army, Navy, Marine installations. Mm-hmm. In fact, the goal of Fort Knox is to be a zero-energy installation probably within the next decade. In other words, we take no energy from outside the gate. We make it all our own. And they'll have some solar arrays. There are some solar arrays going up and other things. But that also helps to keep Fort Knox strong. I mean, you just can't, you don't want to turn that back. So Fort Knox is of great military value, and it's a good bang for the buck for the Department of Defense to keep it. So that's why they kept Fort Knox open. And then they send a brigade there because we have some of the best training ranges and training land. And it was the training ranges developed for the armor community, but they work just as well for the infantry community. And then they sent the Human Resources Command because 9/11. 9/11, Human Resources Command was not inside any installation. It was out in the open in Alexandria, St. Louis, and Indianapolis. 9/11, they wanted force protection. They wanted to protect those organizations. They wanted to bring them inside the gate of an installation. Well, you made sense in Kentucky. And oh, by the way, the airport, Louisville, is right up the road. They'll have a lot of visitors, so the Louisville airport will be busy. But the Louisville airport proves capable. If you don't think the Louisville airport is a capable airport, well, UPS is there. Does that give you any idea mm-hmm. how capable that airport is? So those are some of the reasons that they moved some of those organizations to Fort Knox.
Interesting.
Now, I think a telltale sign of how the growth at Fort Knox is going, in 2005, we had 4 general officers assigned to Fort Knox. At the end of base realignment, there'll be 17 general officers at Fort Knox, to include a 3-star general now, who's already there.
Wow.
He's present on the ground.
Pretty amazing.
It's a big change.
It is a huge change. It's a huge change for the culture of the installation. Huge change in the numbers, of course, and a huge change in the economy.
Well, how have the communities surrounding the base reacted to this? What's their involvement, and then how have they reacted to the expansion? I would hope positively.
That's a great segue. I could tell you that the community outside the gate is known as the most, probably one of the most military-friendly communities in the country. They really embrace the military and its mission. You don't hear anybody complaining about what's going on down there. In fact, I think there's still a vacancy sign over there saying, if you want to send more, that's okay. We can take them. They were so accommodating that as I looked at this project, one of the things that I said very early on, I said, you know, moving Human Resources Command here is easy. You just give me $200 million. If I gave you $200 million, you could build a building, right? You can get somebody to do it. Mm-hmm. That's easy. taking care of the workforce is going to be the toughest challenge. And I still think that remains today the same premise that I used back then. It's still in force. The workforce at Fort Knox, like I said, is changing. And the current workforce is going to be moving to Fort Benning, Georgia, but a lot of them won't want to move. So somehow we have to retrain and reeducate the current workforce to take jobs either in a future workforce or somewhere else in Kentucky if they don't want to move. And for the commands moving here, we want to encourage as many people from those commands to move here. For the Army, it was a matter of efficiency and effectiveness. Can you imagine you have an organization, a Human Resources Command, of over 3,000 people, and if only 300 people moved, now you have to retrain 2,700 people to do jobs that skilled professionals were doing for years? That would take an organization. Can you imagine if we told UPS, you need to move to Montana, and you need to stay just as efficient as you are right now. And by the way, you only can take 10% of your workforce. But you can't do that. So we need to encourage as many of those skilled professionals to move to Kentucky as we can. And for those that don't move, we have to have a program to hire skilled people to take their place and do some kind of knowledge transfer. Gain the knowledge from the leaving workforce and, you know, kind of like pump their brain, you know, pull out the stuff that we need and pump it back into somebody else. Well, when I brought this up to the community about the challenge, I said what would really help is if we went and visited these commands and told them about Kentucky and told them about Radcliffe, Eatown, Hardin County, Meade County, Shepherdsville, Bullitt County, Louisville, Grayson County, Nelson County, and expanded that out and said, we really need to do that. Well, the community at the time, and I didn't know it at first, they were forming an organization called One Knox. One Knox is the Lincoln Trail Area Development District, plus Bullitt County and Meade County. This organization, they were my go-to organization as the garrison commander. They were my point of contact outside the installation that could get the information everywhere. And I was their one point of contact. So the beauty of it, and there's a guy named Brad Richardson that runs it and runs it today. Brad was my man, that if I had to contact the locals and tell them something, I could contact Brad and say, Brad, here's what we need to do. Well, they formed that organization, they hired Brad, and it was shortly after that that I said it would be really great if we went to those places, sending organizations to Fort Knox and told them about Kentucky. I said, I'm going to go. I can control that, and I'm going to take some people from the installation with me. I'm going to take my civilian personnel advisor. I'm going to take my schools. I'm going to take my morale, welfare, and recreation. I'm going to take, you name it. I took probably about 8 people from the installation that had to go. But I said that what would really help is if I could take, you know, some chambers of commerce, some superintendents from outside the gate, some realtor associations. We didn't want to promote any one realty. So realty associations, home builder associations, hospitals, elected officials. Well, lo and behold, within a month, I was taking about 8 or 10, and I had 50 more join on. All the way from, I mean, we had Grayson County, Nelson County, Breckenridge County. We had all the counties in Lincoln Trail Area Development District, plus Bulletin. You know, so Grayson, Marion, LaRue, Breckenridge, Meade, Hardin, Nelson, Bullitt, Jefferson, and then we had the cities. Vine Grove, Radcliffe, Eatown, Brandenburg, someone from Shepherdsville, of course someone from Louisville, and others all came on these road trips. And like we called them the BRAC road shows. And the first one was in 2006. BRAC was announced in May. I came out with my plea in December, and our first one was in January of 2006. So, and then we did another one in 2008, and it was an incredible time, and I think that really helped sell the area, because we had questions, and we sent out ahead of time, we sent out some surveys saying, you know, what are your questions? We're bringing a crew in, we want to know your questions so we can try to answer them. So what are your questions? And we had some questions like, do you have the internet in Kentucky? Do you have shopping malls? How about supermarkets? And when you think about that in Kentucky, it's like, okay. But if you've never been to Kentucky, yeah, and you think about it, maybe that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But those of us that have been here and lived here, we know, yeah, okay, we're about as advanced as anybody else around here. you know, sure, there's some areas that may not have a supermarket close by or a shopping mall close by, but we certainly have them in Kentucky. And, of course, in Fort Knox, I mean, we've got two shopping malls right up the road, and there's one in one in E-Town, and two, Oxmoor and Mall of St. Matthews up there in Louisville. And then, okay, keep going. There's even more the further you go out. So plenty. But it was taking care of some of these rumors and challenging some of the bad expectations I think they had at Kentucky. And another thing that I think was key to them, you know, for the folks, and most of them from Human Resources Command were relocating from Alexandria, by far the bulk. There was only a few hundred in St. Louis and 100 and something in Indianapolis, so the bulk of that was in Alexandria, Virginia, where you know D.C. traffic. D.C. traffic is about some of the worst there is. But we had, when we told them that the airport was 35 miles away, they cringed. Oh, my God. Oh, it's going to take forever to get there. We said, well, it's 35 minutes away. No way. I said, yes, it's really 35 minutes away. Okay, but how about during rush hour? 35 minutes away. And they were astonished that I said, well, yes, traffic increases, but it still doesn't take you any more time to get up to the airport. They were amazed. So we next time we went back, none of our maps, none of them contained anything on mileage. The maps that we displayed about Kentucky and the region they're moving to were all minutes. How long does it take to get from this point to this point? We put it in terms of minutes. Because if you put it in terms of miles, it scared them. So when the question came, well, I have a two-hour commute now. Well, how far can I live away from Fort Knox with a two-hour commute? Nashville. I mean, if you wanted to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But in reality, you could. But I don't think you'd want to live as far as Nashville. But those are some of the things we overcame. But I tell you, the community came together. And I remember one briefing in Alexandria, Virginia, when I was talking to them. And I said, how many of you have met some of your elected officials in the area? And about half the people raised their hand. How many of you have met your mayor? About, you know, five or six out of a couple hundred said they have met their mayor. And I said, I just want you to know, in this audience today, we have three mayors five mayors and three county judge executives. And they're here to talk to you. And they're not even your mayors or county judge executives yet. But they're here because they care. And I thought that a lot of people are taken back saying, wow, you mean we can actually have conversations with our elected officials? And yes, you can. You're not moving, you know, because how often do you see the mayor of Washington, D.C., and you can give him your, but how, you want to go see the mayor of Radcliffe? Make an appointment. Mm-hmm. And she'll see you. You want to see the mayor of E-Town? He'll see you. And he'll talk to you. And he'll take your, you know, take your advice and listen to you. I think that was another key thing that kind of sold folks that, hey, this is not too bad. Now, realize some folks, there was no way in a million years they were going to move to the Fort Knox area. That just wasn't going to happen. They had family in that area. They're very used to living in a city. They've had history in there, and they're not going to move. But I had one lady challenge my way of thinking. It was at Fort Monroe, Virginia, when I was talking to one lady, and she says, after the presentation was over, she came and talked to me. She goes, a very good presentation. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for coming out here. And I said, so what do you think? She goes, well, I've got I have two grandchildren here. I was born here. I went to high school here. My husband and I are now divorced, but, you know, I have a house over here and the family and all that. And I said, well, so you're probably not going to move. She goes, no, I'm moving. I said, why? You're kidding me. I said, why are you moving? You seem like the type. You have family here. You have grandchildren. You live here your whole life. And there's other work you can get in this area. She goes, I can go there, buy myself 10 acres, get a couple horses, and my grandkids can stay with me all summer long. And they will never forget we went to Grandma's farm. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, yes, you can. You can do that. With the money you can make in your house on the East Coast, you could definitely come out here, buy 10 acres, and put a couple horses on it if you want it. You're right. She goes, yeah, I'm really thinking about it. So I thought to myself, I have to change my way of thinking on how to sell this. And, of course, a lot of people looked at it like, yeah, we could sell our house. And even though the equity's down in the market, they could still sell their house for a pretty penny and get a very nice one over here. I don't think they believe the cost of housing, too. On the second roadshow, we actually showed a house that was currently up for sale in the area, and we said, this house is going for $190,000. And they were like, no way. There's no way. Because the house in D.C. would have probably been $600,000-$700,000, and they were kind of shocked, but it was real. It was a real story. We really did take a house right out of the picture mm-hmm. right out of the newspaper, and that was the asking price.
Wow.
So we really tried to sell it. Then I think the important thing, a lot of the groups came here. Even though we went there, some of them decided, they put a group together, and they came and visited us. Mm-hmm. And Brad Richardson from One Knox took care of those visits. That sold them more than anything else.
I want to hear more about how One Knox really got developed, because if BRAC was announced, that community group formed at the same time you were really getting your feet on the ground. It seems like they mobilized very quickly. How did that really come together?
They did. There's a group of elected officials in the Hardin-Meade County area that got together quickly, and they're visionaries. And they said, we just need to put together a group that can control this for us, that can take care of it and be the communication link and get the community informed on this. And so they put together the group, and they're called now the One Knox Policy Council. So it's the Mayor Radcliffe, the Mayor of Eatown, the County Judge Executive of Hardin County, County Judge Executive of Meade County, the Mayor of West Point, and the Mayor of Vine Grove. And so they get together so every so often to give guidance to Brad and his folks about how to do business, but they're the ones that put it together. And it cost. They all contributed some out of their budgets to do it. Now, later on, One Knox got a grant from the federal government, from the Office of Economic Adjustment out of the Department of Defense. The Office of Economic Adjustment is responsible to responding to growth communities and the communities that are closing, trying to help them monetarily plan for the growth. So they paid a grant to pay One Knox and some of Lincoln Trail. In fact, the Office of Economic Adjustment pays about 90% of my salary. I'm really 90% funded by the Department of Defense, even though the governor hired me. And I, at first, he didn't know that when he hired me. He didn't know I was going to try to get a grant, and I didn't know it either. Got that afterwards, which was good. Makes your boss very happy when
and
you come
welcomed.
In with money.
Yeah.
But they did respond very fast with that point of contact. Mm-hmm. And at first, they had someone in there within a couple of months. They didn't form One Knox yet, but Radcliffe had a man that came to all my BRAC meetings, because when I first took over, I had monthly BRAC meetings. And
the community in general.
It was a lawyer, Terry Bennett, from Radcliffe. Terry did a great job, but he was their first representative that came to all my meetings and attended and took the word out to the community outside the gate on what we were doing, just the timelines and everything else. Because you understand, when you these... They wanted to know, when is the brigade coming? When is HRC coming? When are you going to do this? When's this moving? Because this impacts the economy outside the gate. And so it was more and more, I say, folks, when you think of Fort Knox, everybody thinks about a gated installation and, you know, top security. And it is. But it's more open to the community, and Fort Knox feels like it's part of Kentucky than I think any time in the past. It's more that way than ever. At Fort Knox, when I was there as the garrison commander, I realized that we're just part of the community in Kentucky. We can't close ourselves off. We got to be open. And now, I told you, the housing's privatized. The water system's privatized. Hardin County Water District runs the water on Fort Knox. The electricity is privatized, and they're going to privatize the gas system soon. I'm sorry, not water, but the wastewater is privatized. Water will be privatized soon.
Was that difficult to convince the military to let you do that?
I think they were actually pushing the fact. It actually is cheaper in the long run. You know, we couldn't afford, once again, it was kind of like privatizing housing. We can't afford to take care of the water system, but if we turn the water system over to someone who does it for a living, they can do things much more efficiently, effectively than we could.
And it seems like that's a larger movement as well in the military. Probably
it is.
Since like the 70s or
it
maybe
is.
The 80s.
The privatization
maybe
of utilities.
Like Rumsfeld the first time, or, you know, going back that far.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And it's just a smart thing to do. And so you can see Fort Knox depends on the community. And heck, we, in the summertime, we would pump water into Hardin County when they had dry spells, because we had a better water production capability. So we would sell them water. And when I say sell them water, we're forced into selling them at whatever it's cost us. Mm-hmm. We never make a profit. Whatever it costs to create a gallon of water is what we charge them. And for them, it worked out just great. So it's a real partnership, and I think that partnership really strengthened. BRAC brought us all together, and we realized we had to do it together.
And it seems, just you talking about this experience, it seems so seamless. Were there any major roadblocks or challenges that you hit during?
Yeah, there was always funding challenges, and you know, trying to get the infrastructure on post, off post. I'll talk more about that in a minute. But on post, yeah, we had a challenge getting funding. We had to prove ourselves many, many times over, not just for the Human Resource Center of Excellence building, the big one, but other projects as well. I think one of the biggest hiccups was the brigade combat team. According to BRAC, they were supposed to be here in 2006. So even though it might have seemed seamless, when people heard they were coming, and they were told by one military official that you can't build fast enough, build, because they're coming. Well, some people went out there and speculated and built. And then all of a sudden it was delayed. And they said, you know what, they're not coming now until 2008. I'm like, oh, that's 2 years away. And these people built homes. And then they said it was delayed again until 2009. So the brigade wouldn't be here until 2009. A lot of people took hits. They speculated, went out there on a limb, and probably lost some good money. But a lot of them held in and said, we can hold out. We can make it. And sure enough. Now, if you look at the housing market, I talked to one realtor, his wife, not too long ago, month ago or so. And he said, yeah, my husband's got 5 closings this weekend. I mean, you know, that's pretty good for a realtor.
Yeah, very good.
And you know, he sells upscale homes. So the realtors are doing okay now. And business is great. If you talk to folks, they said, yeah, we can tell the soldiers are in. I said, well, how can you tell? Well, they came from Texas, so we see Texas license plates all over the roads. Plus, if you go to Best Buy Friday afternoons, all you see is a sea of soldiers buying electronics. You know, there's one industry that's not in a recession right now, and that's the defense industry. You know, they're still fighting two wars, and these soldiers, no one has been fired on Fort Knox because of a recession. The Defense Department hasn't done that. So the military, the soldiers, and the civilians working there still have the disposable income that many others don't. Mm-hmm. So when you look at it, the military installations around the country, and particularly Fort Knox at Fort Campbell, they've been shielded from the full effects of the recession because they haven't had the layoffs in those counties and regions that other people have had throughout the state. You know, those guys haven't been laid off. So Best Buy's still busy. The restaurants are still busy, and that's a good thing. You know, car lots are still busy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Those are all good things. Now, let me transition a little bit on. I retired in 2008, and I did that for really family reasons. I had been in the Army 26 years, and I didn't like I didn't think I wanted to go and do any other assignments. I didn't want to be put back in a cubicle in a Pentagon or anything like that. So I chose to retire, and the state approached me. It was a couple of folks from the state came and talked to me, and they said, would you be interested in working for the state? And at first, I was kind of hesitant because I hadn't looked at any other opportunities. Yeah. I hadn't thought what I really wanted to do and where I wanted to go with things. But then come about June of 2008, and my change command in July of 2008, I would still be in the Army until, with leave time saved up, I would still be in the Army till October. But it's around June I decided that... I didn't understand at first what the state was looking for me to do, but then I started to get it. Some of the officials from the governor's office and some other folks brought me up to the Capitol and put me in a conference room, closed the door, and they said the governor said not to let you out until you say yes. I realized what they were looking for. They wanted somebody that had the experience with BRAC, knew the community outside the gate, and could translate what the real requirements were, what needed to be done outside the gate to get ready for this growth. In other words, roads, sewer, water, schools, health and family services, and how can we get the biggest bang for the buck, economic development-wise, economic growth out of this? You know, where do we need to spend the money? What do we need to do? And so the governor was looking at me to honcho that because he knew he came, we first met in January of 2007, right after he was elected and took office. He came to Fort Knox for a change of command of the installation. General Williams was leaving command, and General Campbell was taking command. And so they asked me to take him around and show him what was going on with BRAC, because he had just taken over governor, and he had no idea. They said, BRAC, big economic event, a lot of money, a lot of this, moving parts, a lot of jobs. And he really didn't know, and I took him around in a van and showed him and told them, well, this is what BRAC's about, and this is how many jobs we think it's going to be, and this is what we're doing to get ready for it inside the gate. And so he's seen the incredible amount of construction. And I showed him the empty site where now that big building is at. And I said, here's the site. It's going to be a million-square-foot building almost right there. And he goes, you're kidding me. I said, no, it's going to go right there. And So that was the first time we met. And might have been January 2008, I'm sorry, January 2008. And I think he was impressed with how much was really going on, and that it's hard to, when you're outside the gate and you hear about BRAC, sometimes it seems ethereal, like it's not really going to happen. It's nebulous. You can't reach it. You can't touch it. But you get onto the installation and you see $700 million worth of construction going on, it's like, wow, this really is going to happen, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we're building this million square foot building. I'm hoping somebody's going to occupy it. So, yes, it is going to happen, and it's real. And it really feels real when you're on the installation. You see, and you can point to, that's the new construction for the Brigade Combat Team. That's for Human Resources Command. We're going to put this command here, and this command is going here. And this is, and so you can feel it, taste it, touch it. And I think he saw that, and something told him that he had formed a BRAC task force as well, but I think something told him he needs somebody that has a real idea of what's going on the installation, but also has a knowledge of the mayors and county judges and the community leaders outside the gate. And I was probably that trusted agent. So he hired me, and I came to work October 1st, 2008, as a civilian. And my first role, of course, a special assistant to the governor for base realignment. And that same day, the first day, it just happened to be, I took over, and we held the BRAC task force meeting in the Homeland Security conference room and talked about some issues there. And then it progressed, you know, and I tell you, my job, and I look at it as a state, our job as a state is to support those community leaders down there with smart projects, projects that are the right ones. And there's some good projects down there. And when I talk to elected officials down there on projects, I say, look, that's a great project. I think it is. But is it really related to BRAC? Can I really support it because I say growth's going into there? Because there's some, you know, everybody wants to pave roads. But the further you get away from Fort Knox, the less there's a need for transportation. So if you want to do a $20 million road in Grayson County, I'm looking like there's not going to be that much in Grayson County. You're going to get some growth. You probably get 10 to 50 people. I don't know if that calls for a $20 million road. But when you get close in Radcliffe and you see the traffic on 31W standing outside the gates, you know you've got to do something close by. So part of my job was to gain consensus from the local officials on what had to be done. And you think that sounds hard, like take eight counties and all those county judges and mayors and say, what's important, what needs to be done for BRAC? It was the easiest thing to get consensus. It really was.
How was it easy? I can't even imagine that.
Brad Richardson from One Knox, mm-hmm. Wendell Lawrence, the Lincoln Trail Area Development District Director, Executive Director, myself. Three, I think, trusted agents that everybody saw were trying to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And we three together worked on it, and we're able to gain consensus. I mean, we really did. If you go down and you talk to the mayor of Radcliffe and say, what projects do you think are important? She'll go down the list, just the same list that the mayor of E-Town will go over, the same list. And sure, they have their own projects in those, mm-hmm. but they came together as a group and said, this is the prioritized list. And that's what I asked for. I said, what happens if we don't get all the money we need? I'm going to start taking off this project, to finally go up to the, you know, four we can do. Mm-hmm. So the first biennium budget, which was the 8 or the 9-10 budget. Now, BRAC, see, that was the problem with budgets. BRAC was announced in 2005. The first task force for Governor Fletcher got together in 2006. By the time they had their budget and everything together on what was needed, it was 7. In 7, they were forming the 9-10 budget is what was going into effect. Okay, so that's the first time they could interject money into it. We lost a few years just because of the biennium budget process, and when we started up the task force, and I was the commander then, not a special assistant. And so, but they gave $100 million. There was actually almost $300 million of requirements, but they were only able to put $100 million towards it.
The state.
And it was $100 million in bond money. I mean, it's not out of the general budget, it was bonding. But it was $50 million towards roads and $50 million towards infrastructure, water, sewer, schools. This last biennium budget, $151 million were approved. $38.495 million for infrastructure, water and sewer, and $112.5 million for roads. And that was really the road projects were finishing off the first $50 million. $50 million, and that's the thing on roads that people don't understand. You just don't build a road in 2 years. The first budget, the first 2 years of the budget, you can do the design right away and utility work. So you acquire the land, you do the design, and you bury the utilities or move the utilities into the road where they have to go. The next phase, you actually do the construction, which requires the next biennium budget to approve the construction money. So that's when we just got the construction money. So even though BRAC was announced in 2005, most of the road projects will not be completed until 13, 14, just because of the way budgets go. Mm-hmm. But you know what? That's okay. They're going to be complete. It's going to be done. Are we going to be crowded? Yeah, absolutely. If you go on, it's taken double. Right now, it takes you double the amount of time to get from E-Town to Fort Knox in rush hour. Now, instead of 20 minutes, it takes 40 minutes. Is it acceptable? Depends on who you are. But we'll get to that. We will take care of that eventually. But things just don't happen overnight. And now, on post, that was a good thing about being mayor when you're a garrison commander, is that you're a dictator. You don't have to go through a city council. You don't have to go through all those things. They give you the money. You spend it the way you need to spend it. And that was easy. So we were able to do that. So the roads on post, I think, got finished faster than the roads. I know they're finished faster than the roads off post, but that's neither here nor there. The other thing, the water and sewer projects, we really looked at the map and said, where do we really anticipate the growth going? Where is it really going to go? And we took the current workforce and we said, hey, the workforce on Fort Knox, where do they live? And sure enough, we can download zip codes of every civilian employee and say, here's the zip codes and where they live. And you take it, plot it on a map and say, you know, 80% of the population lives in Hardin County. They live in Radcliffe, Elizabethtown, or in the county. And about 10% or so live in Meade County, more surrounding areas, and 10% live in Jefferson County, Southern Indiana, Grayson, LaRue, Nelson, even as far out as Lexington. If you really look at the affected area for BRAC, it goes from Southern Indiana all the way to Bowling Green, and then from Breckinridge County all the way to Lexington. That is the region that we're talking about being affected with this growth. And so we take that, you say, well, this is where we expect about 80% of school children to go. This is where we expect about 80% of this to go. Mm-hmm. And we looked at where the growth was. You know, the Area Development District has a pretty good idea of what the neighborhoods are and where the land's been bought and where the houses are going in. So there's the areas we concentrated in, and also trying to do some smart growth principles and figure out, you know, put people where the infrastructure is, if possible. But we're trying to do other things to build it's the soft pieces of this. You know, building those things, it's money. You just take money and do it. But the soft pieces of this growth are the harder things to scope. And that's let's just build in the quality of place. For this current work, for the future workforce that's coming in, they have a different culture requirements. A higher level of education, they want to do different things. They want bike paths. They want parks. They want museums. They want, and we have all that. But how can we make that accessible, or how can we put more in? As I told one mayor, I said, next time, mayor, you approve a subdivision of 30 homes, have the developer put a bike path around it. You don't spend no money off your back. Just put in your planning that, you know, development over 30 homes, by God, you must have a bike path. Yeah. And you will see that young mother pushing a stroller around that bike path at 9 in the morning. Trust me, if you put it in. Well, that's a pretty good idea. I said, yeah, that will sell that development better than anything else. People are dying for things like that. That's building a quality of place that people want to move to and then go find a job.
How did you know what you needed to advise to do, like bike paths and like the theater? How did you know how to counsel on that?
I guess it was some study, some research, and I like to call them my 101 lessons. When I took this job, I went around to the cabinets and I called it my. For instance, I went to Mike Hancock, who was the chief engineer, the district or the highway engineer for the state. He wasn't the secretary at the time. Mm-hmm. And I said, Mike, I need transportation 101 lesson. Talk to me about it. Just tell me how this stuff works. So I don't know how it works in the state. So I went to see Mike Hancock for a couple hours, and we talked transportation. And he took me around how the funding sources work and where they go and how this works. And, you know, I asked him, why isn't the Bluegrass Parkway connected to 64? He told me that story. You know, why don't we open up this? Because I'm looking at things like that. I said, if you want to open up the region, the Bluegrass Parkway should connect to 64. It would open up a whole thing. And I said, you know, why is this? So we talked and we still talk today about transportation, how to do it. And then I went to the Economic Development Cabinet and talked to Economic Development 101. Mm-hmm. I went to some of the other cabinets, and I got some lessons. One of the things that really helped, right after I took over, Booz Allen Hamilton Company, it's a contracting company, defense contractor, but they're a problem-solving company. They work in the vague, ambiguous area, and they work in the gray area, and they solve problems for you. They came to us and said, you know, free of charge, pro bono, we would like to do a tabletop exercise for you. We think it would be great for this area. They want to do business in the area, and this would get their name known. And so they came in and, free to the state, helped me do a tabletop exercise. And we did this in E-Town. About 133 people showed up. All the cabinet secretaries of the affected areas, mayors, county judges, superintendents, university presidents. I got all those folks in there for an entire day. And we looked at five areas. We looked at economic development, transportation, health and family services, regional infrastructure to include public safety, and I always forget one. Education and workforce. Those are the areas that we looked at. And I had subgroups form in each of them. I came and gave a brief at first, told them how this exercise was going to work. Then we're going to break into subgroups and go forth and talk about what are the problems, what are the recommended solutions, give me a timeline. So workforce, what are some of the issues? Retraining the current workforce. Okay, how do we solve this? And you know, what will it take? If it's money, I got it. Give me the fact. Give me the what you think it is. So for a day, I had them and did that. And that helped me narrow down the focus of where I really needed to start going into it. It formed the basis of a strategic plan. And I've hired somebody to really flesh out that plan. And since we've had follow-on meetings in each of those groups to really look at, are we doing the right things at the right time? And I think some of the things that are spinning off of this, you'd have never had because of, unless BRAC happened. I'll give you an example. Hardin County, they decided to do what they call a visioning project. So look at Hardin County. Where are we going to be 30 years from now? Now that this has happened, where are we going to be 30 years from now? Where can we be 30 years from now? And so they call it Hardin County United now is what they call it. And all the cities in the county and the county itself got together and formed now three subcommittees, governance, community development, and education. And they're looking into these areas saying, where do we want to be, you know, 30 years from now, how we want to go? The things being talked about, I didn't think would happen for 5 years. I saw them happening, but I didn't think we'd get to that point. By the way, that study and there's a contractor that's facilitating that study. It's paid for by the Department of Defense. They got a grant to pay for that study, believe it or not, because the Department of Defense has an interest in making sure that area around Fort Knox builds a quality of place for the soldiers and families that live there. Mm-hmm. Okay, they have an interest. And now they're very, very vocal about, hey, we'll help you do this. So they gave us the money to do it. Some of the things coming out of there, for instance, is mergers of the Chambers of Commerce, of all those areas. Then merger of the economic development authorities they want to do. And believe it or not, the governor's committee is talking about merging the governments. It would become the third largest city in the Commonwealth.
Wow.
It would be bigger than Bowling Green, but smaller than Lexington and Louisville. And they're talking about that now. That is an offshoot of what this base realignment has done. Mm-hmm. It's been such a big boom to the area and a change. Remember I talked about changing the culture? Mm-hmm. It's been a change in the culture. And they realize that it's time to change with it and get ahead of the ball game. So those kind of things are pretty special when you see them happen.
It's massive.
It is. It is.
So Tony kind of suggested this earlier, but what were some of the major challenges in doing this? I think about you went from talking to the head of human resources and saying $17,000 will get you a door to the next step, you have, you know, the $200 million. So there's a lot of space in between there that has to happen.
Yeah.
What was the negotiations, and what were some of the other kind of big challenges that you had to face to make it happen?
Oh, as garrison commander, I think it was more a staffing problem for me at first. In other words, you know, BRAC was announced, and, you know, nobody on the Fort Knox garrison staff was hired to help out with BRAC. All this transformation was coming, but I didn't have anybody to plan, do the planning or anything like that.
Or even know it was really that there wasn't a plan
there, yeah,
to follow.
Exactly. So part of that was figuring out how to shift personnel around and staffing to do this. And believe it or not, I didn't get any help really for 2 years. Not until 2007 when the Army decided to put there another colonel, an engineer colonel, and he was called my deputy garrison commander for transformation. And when he came on board, I hired two contractors to work for him and to help flesh out the details of the plan and some of the other things. For instance, okay, we know that this command is moving to Fort Benning, but when they leave their building, what's the reuse plan? I mean, I didn't have time. I knew I had to do it, but I had time for that thing, you know? Or motor pool space. How were we going to fit all these units into the existing motor pools and not build new? So he helped me do so much of that. But the staffing problem was hard to figure out. I had a lady called Sarah Johnson that did yeoman's work. She is a workhorse. And she helped form a lot of the plan, put some of the business plans together on costs, funding. And if you're smart on those and you you make your case well, you're really marketing and you're selling yourself. You got to go, and just like any place else that's going for money, you got to go before the Army leadership and say, look, this is how we have to do it. This is what we need. As long as you have a good plan and that's in place, they try to support you as much as possible. So, the money came at the proper time. We showed them how much, and a lot of it's engineering work. We have the brigade coming in. We know how many soldiers. We know how many barrack spaces we need. Well, here's how we build the most efficient, effective barracks we have with the money. Mm-hmm. So we did this thing called Milcon Transformation. We really cut 15% off the top and said we can do this cheaper, better, faster by using commercial methods and not military specs. Mm-hmm. What would the commercial side do? So we went to commercial-type building and said, what would you do? So we were able to build that, but we're also able to put in some things that we thought were important. The extra-strength drywall, because the soldiers will kick it and hurt, We put in flexible concrete in the floors that allow it to give some give, and some things we did that made sense. Standing seam metal roof, geothermal energy systems we put in, brick, and windows that don't open. The worst thing, believe it or not, I will tell you, once you have a very efficient building that moves the air very well, you don't want to open windows, because soldiers will open windows, and what happens? The moisture and the heat or whatever come in, and you get mold, you get mildew, you get rust, so you keep the windows from opening, but you have a ventilation system that pushes air around. It makes it very, very comfortable and very efficient. So we did things like that and figured that out. But I thought staffing was tough at first. Going after the money and finding out what the right projects to do and when. And then it was the little projects, where the sidewalks have to go. Because mom's going to walk her kids to school. And if there's not a sidewalk to get to that school from this new area, you've got to put it in. And just those little things, street lights and, you name it, speed cameras. Yes, we have speed cameras on Fort Knox. Anywhere else
note to self. How about it seems like they're existing. You have the unique position of being able to see this from both the active duty federal side as well as the state side now. How did that relationship develop throughout this whole BRAC process? Or how has it? I guess it's still developing, I would imagine, as well.
It's still developing. I do work directly for the governor in that role, and I try to keep him as informed as possible. This governor really gets it. He understands the economic impact of this growth, and he's a very staunch supporter of the military. He was in the military. He's former military. He understands, and that has made this job so much easier. And he's given me the authority to go down there and talk to the folks I need and get the things done. And I think I had my first conversation when I'm told, Governor, I'm probably going to piss some people off. But I said, because I'm going to push the envelope. I'm going to push things where I need to push it and push hard. He goes, you just keep pushing. I'll tell you when to back off. And he's done that. I mean, he's a great leader in this respect. He has really given me the reins and let me run with this. And I'll tell you, just some of the working relationships I think I have with the folks in the region have helped, and I have kept them informed. And I think they know I'm their advocate. Mm-hmm. And now I'm not going to let them go crazy. It's not up to me. It's up to the governor. But, I'm not going to recommend to the governor silly projects, and I think they know that. But I will help them wherever they need to and push it. So, and, of course, I think I've developed some good relationships with the legislature. And the other thing about my role, I'm nonpartisan. I don't, even though I work for a Democratic administration, I'm seen as nonpartisan. I see as playing both sides, and so I think that really helps when it comes to working with the elected officials and the legislators in the region. I'm a trusted agent. I'm going to tell them the truth, and I'm not going to put a political spin on it, because that's not what we need. And the governor has seen this the same way. This is not a political thing. I mean, this growth was thrown upon us. Building out and helping them get the biggest bang for the buck out of the growth, both sides ought to support that, don't you think? You know, that's one of those things. So I think that's helped me tremendously. But if I think the frustrating parts, there have been some frustrations. Of course, biennium budgets are a frustration. You know, I'd like to see it every year. State, the way the state funds things and collects revenues is a problem. Most of the revenue for the state goes to the state. It doesn't go to the local community. They collect some property taxes. They collect, in some cases, some occupational taxes. But they cannot do a special purpose local option sales tax. They can't, you know, they can do a nickel growth tax. But so the state is having to fund all these water and sewer projects. But that's where the money goes. I wish we had a different revenue raising system, that the locals could take more responsibility and raise their own. Yeah, some they can do tax incremental financing and things like that. That's creative, but those are hard. They have to be approved by the legislature. And so we don't have them, some of those things that other states have in order to do it. I think that's been tough. Of course, frustration has been the tough budget times the state's in. I'm glad I'm federally funded, but it hurts the projects when you have more projects you want to do, but you know you got to temper that appetite for projects with reality. And that's been tough. That's been a balancing act to say, you know, I know we have $180 million worth of roads still left, but we're only going to do 112 right now. 112 million more in construction. That's all we can afford. And then I do a lot of work with the federal government. I talk to our congressional delegation quite a bit about helping out where we can. The federal government has not been as forthcoming as I would like in helping out with this growth. Sure, they felt on post, and that's their responsibility. But Transportation Cabinet hasn't put one penny into any roads at Fort Knox for this. That's the Department of Transportation, USDOT. The real money that's come in from the federal government has been for planning, you know, from like my job, planning. They've done economic impact studies, labor study, transportation studies they paid for. They can do that kind of planning. But brick-and-mortar solutions, building schools, they don't do. So there's been no money for schools that have come down to help. How they got the money was the communities raised, they raised their taxes. They put growth nickels. They have these things called growth nickels. You raise their property tax 5 cents for every $100 assessed value. That money helps them bond new schools. Meade County has 3 growth nickels. Hardin County has 2. That's a tremendous amount of burden upon the population to do the schools. Luckily, we have a very patriotic and supportive group in the region that understands their responsibilities. But I wish I could get them some federal money from the Department of Education to pay for it. One area we've gotten a lot of money from is labor, though. The labor cabinet is really almost all the workforce, really all the workforce money that's been gone into workforce development has been federal. The Workforce Investment and Regional Economic Development grant of $5 million was really the Hardin County area. The Lake Natural Area Development District really got that, and the state got it because of BRAC. That was the real reason it came. And there's been some national emergency grants and others to help out in the workforce side that have been very helpful. But I wish I could get some more brick-and-mortar money. Now, that might soon be changing. There's some changes in the works that might just allow us to do that, but don't know yet. But that's been frustrating that I can't go out, you know, because I don't want the state to have to do everything. I wish the locals wish they could do more, but they're handcuffed. And then the federal government, you know, I wish I could get more money. But our congressional delegation has been great. You know, I do go to them and ask them. There'll be probably some earmarks coming down. I'm hoping this next year to help fund some of these projects that we want to do.
How is the relationship with the transition with the new garrison commander of Fort Knox and you as an outgoing? Has that been a good transition from you to move to this and still get to work with them on that?
Yeah, it has been. I think it has been. My successor, Colonel Rick Schwartz. Rick is a great guy, great temperament, and I, you know, he had a couple meetings before I left, and he took over. I said, Rick, you know, I've done a lot of the planning, and I started the buildings and doing, you know, all that stuff. And I said, Rick, that's been the easy stuff. These guys are really coming. And when they start moving in here, that's going to be the tough stuff. That's when the tempers flare and the attitudes change and the culture starts moving and changing. And you've got the tough. I've had it, you know. People said I had a tough job. I said, Rick, you've got the tough one. Mm-hmm. And he's going to be there 3 years. He leaves next year, after 2011. And Rick has truly had some challenges. The money hasn't been as forthcoming for some of the things he's probably wanted to do. And in other areas, he's had plenty of funding. But he's had to move people in. And actually, you know, I was there, and we got the barracks built. But he actually saw soldiers moving into this place now. And so those growing pains come with challenges. But Rick is a great man. We've had a good relationship. He sits as a member of the BRAC, an ex officio member of the BRAC task force. So he briefs every time the BRAC task force meets. He's part of it. I'm also the commissioner on the Interstate Compact for Educational Opportunities for Military Children, helping military children transition from post to post. You understand that's kind of hard. You know, and a lot of people don't realize that, but when kids move, and BRAC is going to be a lot of moves for kids, they'll come from Virginia, and it used to be. They would come to Virginia for, you know, to some state, and that state, they would be a senior, and the state would say, well, you know, you need Oklahoma State history to graduate. Because, well, I took Virginia State history, and I took Kentucky State history the last time. I've had a state history, but you haven't had Oklahoma's. You can't graduate. It's like, that doesn't make any sense, does it? I mean, but those kind of things are problems, and the Interstate Compact is meant to change things and make it easier. States agree to fix the problem between themselves instead of getting the federal government involved with a compact. Rick sits as part of that Interstate Compact, too. In fact, there's a video the state created, and Rick is on that video with his daughter talking about some of the transitions they did. So he has been an integral part of this and has helped me along the way. Tell me what his needs are, and I can also tell him some of the realities we have at the state. You know, this is how it – from, you know, in my limited experience, which is very limited at the state, but this is what I think our options are. And so and that's worked out great. Plus, I do get to the installation quite a bit, and I talk to folks, keep them up to date on what I'm doing. Again, I think a lot of it's communications. You really just keep everybody informed. Good news or bad news, keep everybody informed. Let them know what's going on. And be the honest broker. You know, tell them what you really think. And Rick has done that for me tremendously. And he'll call me up. He thinks there's an issue or he wants to get some thoughts on it from my point of view. Take it or leave it. Here's your free advice.
I got a question on you talking about coming to your command with no plan of action for BRAC. What models did you look to at that time, and really has the way that this that BRAC has really come to fruition in Kentucky at Fort Knox, has that become a model for other installations across the nation that are looking to this as a project that they can build upon?
Yeah, I think in some ways it has. I clearly, with the energy projects we're doing on Fort Knox, people are doing that, but realize that people are getting smart on energy around the Army and other services, and they have to do it differently. You know, how you do an energy project at Fort Irwin, California, is much different. They're about to build the biggest solar array there is out there. But, you know, solar arrays don't work that well in Kentucky. Wind power doesn't work worth a darn out here in Kentucky, but it works in other places. So people are getting smart on how to do that. But I think Fort Knox is looked at as they were smart on energy in accordance with where they were in the country. Where geography placed Kentucky, Fort Knox has taken advantage of that situation, and others are looking to do the same thing. Hey, what are our advantages in Wisconsin? Mm-hmm. You know, that's really helped. I think we're, to tell you the truth, I'm talking at an Association of Defense Communities conference in August, and I'm on two panels. One of the panels talks about success in growth communities, and they asked me to sit on it. And Fort Knox, realized Fort Knox, the growth, it sounds big, and it is in a rural community like we have, but the growth at Fort Meade, Maryland, outside D.C., is going to be in the neighborhood of 60,000 jobs moving in there. And Fort Bliss is getting 30,000, and they have 30,000 school-age children increase. So their growth is big, but relatively, they're in a big city. You know, this growth is different. But I think what people look at as success in Kentucky is the partnerships that were formed, and how the state works with the region, works with the locals, region I call One Knox and Lincoln Trail Air Development District, and then the communities surrounding Fort Knox and Fort Knox itself, and how everybody partners and is a collaboration, and nobody's fighting against each other. because you have that in other places. Mm-hmm. Well, we want this to happen here, and we want this to happen here. You know, the E-Town mayor understands that this project's got to go in Radcliffe, and the Radcliffe mayor understands that that project needs to go to Vine Grove, and it's just the way it is. And that doesn't happen everywhere. So I think that cooperation and the partnerships and processes that were formed, and I have a slide that kind of shows that, I think that's been one of the key successes in Kentucky. And the other piece is $250 million from the state to support the growth. That's no small amount. If you take that in comparison to some of the bigger, you know, the D.C. area that's getting that growth, they have a lot more money. Mm-hmm. You know, it's chump change to them, but for us, that's a considerable amount in this hard times. And so that stands out to mm-hmm. some of the Department of Defense folks to say, wow, Kentucky's really pulling, doing its part to help on this. And that, you know, frankly, they thank us. Thank you for doing this for us.
So what's the 50,000-foot view of looking over base realignment across the United States? What, how does this fit within that larger context?
It's all about divesting of excess infrastructure. It's all about efficiencies and effectiveness in the Defense Department and trying to consolidate functions and also protect them. Mm-hmm. So by doing this, they're going to close. They're closing Fort Monroe. That installation is closing. That's an East Coast installation in a very popular area. That will save a lot of money over time. Now, they have to build out other stuff, move stuff from Fort Monroe, but eventually that will go, and they'll transfer that to the state, and there'll be some payback or fair market value for the property or something. But they'll get the money back. The overall view of the Defense Department is rid ourselves of excess infrastructure that's no longer needed. We're not the Cold War military anymore. That's the 5,000 or the 50,000 foot view of where the Defense Department's going. Also, gain valuable training land and maintain it. You know, I mean, you're not going to get any more land. There's only so much. Mm-hmm. And the Defense Department needs acres to train on. That's just the way it is. So where you have the biggest military value, like Fort Knox, keep it. Mm-hmm. Save it. Don't divest it. So you see the big installations, Fort Hood, Fort Irwin, Fort Bliss, White Sands Army Missile Range, Fort Stewart, Georgia. They're the big super installations now. If you ask me, I think the Army's down to its what we call the enduring installations, the ones that are going to stay long term, just because they have to. They're the big ones. That's the 50,000-foot view. If you ask me the 50,000-foot view for Kentucky, here's what I'd say. The Defense Department is looking at how we do this, how we respond to the growth. I think they're very positive on our response right now. So let's say another BRAC round happens in 2015. Will they look positively on Kentucky and throw us more growth? We also have the opportunity right now to, I like to say this in the region, this region is going to build themselves an identity. The Human Capital Institute held its summit at Fort Knox this year. They do human relations, human resources. Mm-hmm. They had never done that if the largest human resource firm in the entire world wasn't right there. Mm-hmm. So they found that to do it. I think the region is going to build an identity. When I talk about a regional identity, the things that come to mind are Silicon Valley, the Research Triangle, North Carolina. You've heard of those places.
Yeah.
Okay, well, why can't we build an identity, something like that here, grow upon that, secure investment, entrepreneurs come in, innovation happens. And, you know, I see something like the unbridled spirit of innovation happening in that region. Consolidate the government, becomes the third largest government. They get more powers, more money, more able to do different things. The consolidation leads to a centralized police department, a centralized fire department, saving money. See what I mean? They even talked about consolidating the schools. Talk about a religious event. You don't want to consolidate schools. That's the
county and city schools, especially.
That's the problem. But where this grows is growing a quality of place that people want to move to. Right now, the way people graduate from college, you know, you guys are young. You graduate from college now, like my daughter, she's like, I think I want to go live in Chicago. What do you think about a job? Nah, I just want to go live in Chicago. It's like six down on our list is find a job. You know, vacation, move to Chicago, buy this dress. So, oh, yeah, I need a job. When I graduated from college, it was job. You know, wherever I got a job is where I'd move to. Well, nowadays, they move to where they want to go, where they want to be, where the leisure time activities are. You know, so you see communities like Chicago and D.C. and Denver and others because they have this quality of place. You know, Denver's one of the top bike riding cities in the country. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Mayor Jerry Emerson? He knows this. He's building a 100-mile bike path in the 21st century parks. That's to build a quality of place that a innovative entrepreneurial workforce wants to move to. That's what we want to do. So you have the economic engine of Louisville. You're about to have a huge economic hub. You already do in the Hardin County, Elizabethtown, Radcliffe area. Mm-hmm. Build that hub, sprocket off of that economic engine in Louisville. And now you have really what they used to call the triangle in Kentucky was Louisville, Lexington, Northern Kentucky. You better think about something south of Louisville now. That is a force to be reckoned with. BRAC is making all that happen. That's wow. The 50,000-foot view in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. That's going to be an economic engine that's going to be unbelievable in the future.
Wow. So how does – you were – well, earlier on in your career, I guess, into the Cold War, late 80s, early 90s, there was a round of base closures that were happening at that point. While you were in, did you notice it from – I mean, looking at it from that perspective?
No, I didn't have a clue. I was at Fort Dix when the talk was first comes out that Fort Dix was going to close, and I thought nothing of it. I remember them talking about, why do we need to keep Fort Dix open? And they came out with the reasons. Well, it's a great reserve training post. I looked at myself, that's a great reason to close. it was opening up for reserves coming in and doing training us, and they did end up closing. But I really didn't think about base realignment at all until 2005.
So I was curious if that had any impact on anything.
No impact at all. No. I mean, I just didn't think about it. I was too busy doing other things. But, and of course, hey, a lot of people at Fort Knox didn't think about base closing until that happened either. But they weren't as close as I was to it. Mm-hmm. As the garrison commander, it's my job to really plan for all those incoming units and to help the Armor Center leave, help them move where I had to. So, yeah, I was intimately involved with it. But a lot of others on post just went about their jobs, just keep going. And it really had little effect on them. Mm-hmm. But now I think a lot of Hardin counties are seeing, it is having an effect on us. It takes longer to get from one place to another. I have no rentals. Best Buy's busy on a Friday. There's a bunch of soldiers at the car lot buying cars. And, a deploying unit. When the unit deploys, they're gone for a year. And you lose out on that economic impact until they come back with all the money they didn't spend for a year. And I admire some of the car dealers over there. One guy told me, he says, yeah, I had a specialist come in and try to buy this car, and I had to tell him, specialist, you really can't afford this. Well, I said, I just got some money coming back from deployment. Yeah, but you need to save it. You need to spend it elsewhere. The car dealers were doing so well, they were turning soldiers away that they thought just didn't have the rank and the seniority and the paycheck to really support their buying habits. Mm-hmm. So really, if you're doing that well where you can turn soldiers away, that's great. And they were. Some of them were very... I call them my, the principled few sometimes, that they really have some principles and some ethics there. And that's, believe it or not, it's most of them. Yeah.
And it just seems like the mindset surrounding, with the community surrounding Fort Knox, like you were saying, they really have that.
They do. Taking care of soldiers and their families. Yeah. They really try to do that. A lot of them offer discounts.
At every level.
At every level.
Yeah.
Exactly. Soldiers get 10% discounts in Lowe's, or all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's phenomenal.
It is.
That really helps.
Yeah.
So, and you have that attitude in the region. And a lot of it's because there's, in that area, I retired in Kentucky. A lot of people retire in Kentucky that worked at Fort Knox, that were stationed at Fort Knox. So you have a lot of retirees in that region. Mm-hmm. And they know what it's like to be a soldier, and they want to help those young soldiers out there. Let's face it, these guys are deploying more than anybody in. They're gone more than the people in World War II. I mean, now we've been going on longer than World War II.
Yeah.
World War II was 41 to 45, really. Mm-hmm. We've been going since 2001. Now it's 2010. Been long.
Long, hard road.
Mm-hmm.
So where to from now? Where's the, looking at the next 5 to 10 years, what are the challenges you foresee? And
well, like I said, I think the roads will be done by 13, 14. I think still the greatest challenge is workforce development. We don't have the workforce in here yet. And the displaced workforce, a lot of it's yet to be trained because the Armor Center hasn't left yet. Fort Knox is right now approaching a peak. It'll go down once the Armor Center leaves, but they're approaching that peak, which means everything's crowded. And that workforce, they have to be unemployed first before they can be trained and re-educated. And there's some money out there to help them do that, but they're not unemployed yet.
Yeah.
We have to wait till they leave their jobs. that still has to happen. But what you're seeing too is you're seeing a lot of workforce, holes in the workforce right now. Give you an example. Human Resources comes in here and they have an information technology job for a GS-13, which is pretty high. GS-13, there's 15, the GS level goes up to 15, 1 to 15. GS-13 is pretty high. Probably paid somewhere around $100,000 a year, a little over. And so they have this opening, and somebody from Recruiting Command says, Human Resource Command has an opening. I'm a GS-12. I'll get promoted and go into that 13 slot. So that person takes that job in Human Resources Command. Well, now there's a hole in Recruiting Command that has to be filled. So Recruiting Command advertises positions. It said we have this position for a GS-12. And somebody in Hardin County Memorial says, I'm going to take that federal job. I'm going to jump on that and get into the federal system. So they leave, and now Hardin Memorial Hospital has to fill it. And so that turmoil is going to happen for the next 3 years, I think. It's going to take 3 years until that all settles out. And during a labor study, it was found that we knew there were going to be there. In the information technology side, the study projected that if all of the information technology specialists at Fort Knox didn't move to Fort Benning, Georgia, they all stayed, and that if we took all the information technology specialists we had in the area and they all worked at Fort Knox, there would still be a gap of 400 that needed to be filled. In other words, we would do a brain drain on the region and there would still need 400 more.
Wow.
In human resource generalists and specialists, the gap was 600. You needed 600 more.
Yeah.
So, yep, there's going to be some people from Geek Squad moving into Fort Knox, and you're going to have to fill those holes. Those holes will eventually get filled. People move here, advertise, you'll pay for it, whatever, but it'll eventually get filled. But right now, you're going to have that little bit of brain drain going on in different areas while the workforce kind of settles out. That's going to be the challenge. That's going to be the hardest challenge. The infrastructure in the schools, they're going to take care of it. Schools have been, we have been blessed by some superintendents that are very visionary. Nanette Johnston at Hardin County Schools and Mitch Crump in Meade County Schools have been just terrific. Doing the growth nickels, doing that, but also figuring out how to do this, because the demographics of the children that came in got a lot more younger kids now than older kids. So they converted a middle school to an elementary, built it out a little bit, did some renovations. They didn't have to build any schools. There were some projects to build schools already, mm-hmm. and they got them completed faster, but they didn't have to build any new ones just for BRAC. They did renovations, which cost less, and they changed the grade structure to, you know, less in the middle schools and high school area, but more in the elementary preschool. And so they were able to make some things change. And that probably has to do the big R word too, the redistricting, you know, type thing. They might have to do that. I don't want to get into that. That's a dangerous thing. But they're willing to stand up and do those things. So I think the schools will be worked out. But I think what we don't know yet is really what's going to be the true economic impact of this.
Mm-hmm.
That will be found out. And by the way, the Department of Defense is paying the University of Chicago to help us do a benchmarking study to look at what were we doing in 2005 and where are we now, and do some benchmarking to find out, did we get the biggest bang for the buck, and what areas could we possibly, what are the indicators to say we could do more? So they're going to do that for us. They're paying for it because I asked for that to be done. And I wasn't the only one asking for it. Other people asked the Department of Defense, and they paid the University of Chicago, contracted with them to do that for us. No charge. That's all federal money.
Yeah.
So we got to see that. But I think for the people in the region, they're going to see a slow cultural change. Slow, but really in real growth terms, it's probably pretty fast because this BRAC was thrown upon us. But they're really going to see that cultural change. Now you have an industrial-based workforce changing to a knowledge-based workforce. You have where you had a high school graduate doing a job, now you have a college graduate or possibly a master's degree person. That person thought education was important for them. By God. If you have, do you have any kids?
No.
Any kids? No. Kids?
No.
Well, you went to college, right?
Yes.
If you have kids, would they go to college? Okay.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
You thought education was important for you, right? By God, your kids are going to college.
Mm-hmm.
These are going to think the same way. That's a change in Kentucky. Okay. So that industrial-based workforce goes, knowledge-based workforce, they think more about that. The other thing about a knowledge-based workforce, I don't think they're afraid to pick up the phone and call the mayor. or the superintendent and say, you know, I'm just not happy with this. I've seen this development go in, and I didn't like the bike path, not wide enough, whatever. And I think they're going to be more vocal. And they're going to want to see, you know, I think they are going to go to the Muhammad Ali Center, and they're going to go see the symphony. They're going to go see the opera. I think they're going to play some, you know, they're going to drink some beer and play some...
Cornhole?
Thank you. Cornhole on the weekends.
She knew because of the movement.
The movement of the arm there got me.
See, it's so simple.
It's either that or horseshoes.
And I think they're going to do that, but the it's just going to be a different culture that moves in its place, this workforce. Mm-hmm. And they... You're also going to have a workforce. The average age of the workforce moving here is 53 years old for the HRC. They're kind of old. And so they can retire in a couple of years. I think a lot of them are moving here. They're going to get an apartment, and they're going to stand on their head for 2 years until they're retirement eligible, and then they're going back to Washington, D.C. But that's okay. In its place, you're going to have to hire someone. That's what the workforce turmoil we talk about. But you're going to have to hire someone, and you will. But eventually, you're still going to replace that person with a person with the same level of education, same background, same values. And, that, more than anything else, is going to change the face of that region. And again, it's a possibility that the region develops an identity similar to that of Silicon Valley and Research Triangle and other places that you think of when you think of, you know, regional identities. Austin has the semiconductor place, and Atlanta. There's some real possibilities. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the big view. That's the future. But it's going to be... BRAC is legally supposed to be over with. All the moves are supposed to be completed by the services by September of 2011. And they pretty much, for Kentucky, will be. I don't know if all the Armour Center will be out, but almost all of them, it should be just about done, if not done. Mm-hmm. But it won't be really done for Kentucky. We still have the roads to build, the schools to tweak, the infrastructure still needs to get finished, and of course, the culture, the bike paths, the quality of place that will move in after that.
We have, Sarah knows this, we have these aha moments we have around here. What is, I'm sure you've had several moments along this whole process where it just, this has been the most rewarding experience of, you know, something has popped out at you. What, any of those come to mind? Or what is most rewarding about what you've done?
Well, I think seeing it happen, to actually, you know, be sitting there in August of 2005 with $17,000 to move this command in, no plan, and I got to brief the Army staff in 2 weeks as to what the plan is, and to actually see now the building being occupied, $200+ million building now occupied with people in the exact place that I told it, I said it was going to go. And now the largest office building in Kentucky, and to actually see the folks moving in from those locations. I think that's been, that I've been able to stay here and watch that happen, it's been terrifically rewarding. I'll give you an aha moment. I think the most rewarding thing I've seen is the coming together of a community to make this happen. Of the leaders in that region working together, not against each other, but together to make this happen. And it really has been a privilege to see that. I think, you know, on the BRAC Roadshow, even though we went out there and talked to folks and everything, it did more for us than it did for them. It brought us together. I mean, we had, and I used to call them after-action reviews. In the Army, we have these things called after-action reviews. After you get done with an exercise or a training session, bring everybody in and you do this. Okay, what did we do wrong? What did we do right? How did we improve? Blah, blah, blah. And after each event at the BRAC Roadshow, we went and talked to this group. And afterwards, at the hotel, at the bar, sitting there, I'd say, okay, guys, at 5 o'clock, we're going to have an after-action review in the bar. All it was just pulling everybody together at the bar. Mm-hmm. And just not really, I wasn't really hammering them on what was wrong, what was right. It was just a chance to get together socially. And I tell you what, we built relationships there that will never, ever go away. I mean, that time was just precious. So we worked hard and played hard. And I think seeing that come together, like I said, I think the BRAC Roadshows did more for us than it did for them.
Can see that.
Yeah, it was good. And Brad Richardson, the guy from One Knox, he'd probably tell you more. He's another guy you ought to think about bringing in here. He's got some great perspectives on things because he's been in there from the beginning. Brad came out of kind of semi-retirement. He He'll tell you. He had his midlife crisis, and he moved to St. Thomas and started a scuba service. He's down there for a number of years, but then missed his grandchildren and came back to Kentucky. He was in the Economic Development Cabinet, and he was with the city of Louisville, and worked as a task force with the lieutenant governor years ago. But he's a good man. He understands a lot of these things that happened to him. He's got no military background, so he could give you some great perspectives from the civilian side.
Yeah.
But I think for Kentucky, this is a watershed moment in that region. And also, said, I got to hand it to the governor for understanding the economics about this and how it is an economic development event. It is important. A lot of people don't consider the defense industry important. When you think about the industries in Kentucky, you think of automobile industry, you think of tobacco, you think of coal mining, right?
Mm-hmm.
How many people think of the defense industry? The defense industry is the biggest industry in Kentucky that could displace out of it. It's a $9.5 billion industry in 2006. It is the largest industry. It employs more people, if you look at it. It employs more people than manufacturing. It employs more people than agriculture. It employs more people than coal mining. And the payroll is the largest. It's the defense industry. Kentucky is number 4 in the number of active duty soldiers stationed in the state. Number 8 in the number of active duty military stationed in the state. The only people who have more active duty Army than Kentucky is Georgia, North Carolina, and Texas.
Wow.
People don't realize that.
That does put it in perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a big industry. And what do we do with the other industries? We try to grow them, right? We need to grow the defense industry. The governor gets it. Larry Hayes, Secretary Hayes, Economic Development Cabinet, gets it.
Mm-hmm.
It's an industry that you can grow.
So are you liking what you're doing now?
I do enjoy it. It's fun. I still get to work with a lot of people I worked with before. I get to work with some great people. There's some great people on the cabinets. It's unbelievable. I told the governor I'm very impressed with the quality of the state government staff. I mean, I thought I had good people working for me at Fort Knox, which I did, but these people are of equal caliber. A lot of professionals that are really, they don't get paid enough. They do a lot, and they don't get paid enough for their jobs, but they're such a professional, and they know it. And these, some of these cabinet secretaries and people that work for them, they could be making a lot of money somewhere else, and they know it, but they're here to do their best for Kentucky. I hope to say I'm trying to do the same thing. I'm here trying to do my best for Kentucky. It's all about Kentucky and trying to make the right decisions to grow us. And that's what it's all about. I say I'm a card-carrying Kentuckian. I have a Kentucky license. Till I retired, I had a New Jersey license forever.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, New Jersey had a non-picture license from years and years ago. Everybody asked me about my driver's license. Well, here it is. That's not your driver's license. Yes, it is. But it doesn't have a picture. Yeah. But it's my driver's license. But when I retired, I had to become a Kentucky resident, so I got my Kentucky license. So I'm a card-carrying Kentuckian now. So I have a vested interest. What's in it for me? What's in it for me, the average Kentuckian? How can we get the most out of this? How can we grow it right? That's the bottom line. That's what we're trying to do.
You can tell the passion, that's for sure.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Do you plan on ultimately staying in Kentucky as far as you can see now?
As far as I can see now. You know, if somebody wants to offer me $250 million to do something somewhere else, I'll probably jump. I had some other offers in Florida and some other places when I was retiring, probably for better money too. But, you know, I saw this job as somebody needs to do it. And since I knew about BRAC and I knew the community, I was probably the guy that needed to do it. So I stayed. And I live in Versailles now, and I have 2 kids. One's at the University of Kentucky. The other one just graduated the University of Kentucky. She's an art major. Not finding a job too well, but
maybe to Chicago.
Yeah, she's not. Doesn't have the money, and Dad's agreement was, I pay for your college. After that,
yeah,
you know, I did my end of the bargain. Mm-hmm. You're on your own now.
Mm-hmm.
But they live close to home, close to Versailles. They're in Lexington. And my wife works in Lexington. I work in Frankfurt. Life is good right now. So, yeah, I see myself staying in Kentucky for the foreseeable future. I don't know if I'll stay in Versailles.
Mm-hmm.
I might move back to the Hardin County area over time. And I moved away from there. A lot of people thought that I would move and stay in there and just work in Frankfort, but stay in the Hardin County area. And I really thought this more through on an ethical basis. A lot of these projects I'm doing, schools, water, sewer, roads, you know, I could just imagine, how if I lived in E-Town and one of the projects was right near my house?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, you know, he supports that project because he's Nobody can say that it's going to benefit me in my house. I live in Versailles, and I also there's a tendency for Etown, Radcliffe, and Vine Grove to kind of, there's some competition, believe me. And so it's like, well, he cares about Etown if I lived in Etown, or Hillian cares about Radcliffe because I live in Radcliffe. And that's not true. Mm-hmm. And there's less competition than there ever was, but there's some folks down there that just see it that way. And I said, I'll take myself out of that. They can't accuse me of helping one or the other. I'm in for the region. And I live in Versailles. Yeah. It allows me to get on the Bluegrass Parkway and head right that way down.
Yep.
But not via 64.
I can't get on 64. Yeah, there's some, I won't say it on tape, of why 64 doesn't connect to the Bluegrass Parkway, but you probably know.
No, but I'll ask afterwards. Well, it sounds like that they couldn't have made a better selection.
Well, I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Like I said, I'm having fun. I'm trying to make a difference. And hopefully, well, I said, if you haven't seen Fort Knox, you haven't been on it, you can probably go. You can get into the gate, sign in the visitor center, and say you want to go see the, you know, I want to go see the museum and other stuff. And it's a happening place. And if you go see Radcliffe and everything like that, you'll see there's two new motels going up at the intersection of 313 and 31W. Two brand new hotels. They would not be going in if it wasn't for this. Those are some of the spin-off jobs. It was predicted that it was 5,000 jobs at Fort Knox, but for every two jobs created on the installation, one job would be created in the service area off post. That's coming true. New coffee shop, new hot dog place, new parcel, you know, a box, you know, you ship it company, hotels, probably, hopefully a convention center will be going in, some other restaurants going in. It was all that brack. And it was those are spin-off jobs. You can't count on them, but they're probably happening.
It's a great, you know, and maybe in a few years we can come back and talk about how it actually ended up.
How it's really going. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny, if I would have been talking here in 2005, I wouldn't have had a clue. So I don't think, you know, I just don't know how it's going to turn out. I know it's happening because it's law. And a lot of people thought, too, when BRAC law, it's law. And so they thought, when this was announced, a lot of people, including elected officials, said it'll never happen. And I said, I don't think you understand. It's law. The Army doesn't break the law. If Congress has directed us to do this, by God, it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Unless Congress redirects us not to do it. That's the only way it won't happen. And here's the problem. Congress is not going to open up that can of worms again. Because if you say this one post isn't going to happen, then, well, Fort Monmouth will say, well, we don't want our post to close. And Fort Monroe will say, we don't want our post to close. And it opens up a can of worms across the entire United States. And there was no way Congress was opening up that decision again. So it was going to happen. And I tried to tell a lot of officials that right off. I said, oh, it's going to happen. But we don't have any money for it. It's going to happen. If we had to put people in tents somehow, but that it done happening, but it was going to happen. I remember going up, one of my early ventures up to Louisville to talk to the mayor up there. I think it was my first venture to talk to Jerry Abramson. And I went up there and I said, Mayor, I might have a brigade coming here in 2006. I won't have the money to build out until 2006-07. It won't be built until 07. I might need to contract a lot of your hotel space up here for soldiers and bus them down every day. But have them in hotels and motels in the Louisville area, because there's not wasn't enough in Radcliffe and Hardin County. Mm-hmm. I said, I might have to contract hotel space from you, and I'll just contract a hotel. I'll buy it, you know, and maybe for a year I'll put soldiers, single soldiers in this place. And he's like, hey, no problem. You know, that's what I thought. Some contingency plans, just if I didn't get the money.
Yeah.
We'd have to do that until it was built, right? But it was going to happen.
$17,000 or not?
Yeah.
I guess the $17,000 would have paid for a door and a hotel.
Yeah, it would have paid for the door and a hotel. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And paid for breakfast.
For a month, maybe.
And a continental breakfast.
Continental breakfast for the soldiers in the hotel. But, you know, that was a funny story about $17,000, but true. That's how much the business plan called for.
That's unbelievable. I mean, I know.
They want me to renovate existing infrastructure to do it.
Oh, but still, with $17,000?
Gang latrines and open bay barracks and gang latrines. And plus, if you saw it recently, there was a 20-year anniversary of the Americans with Disability Act. You remember seeing that, ADA?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would have to. We had a series of barracks that will probably be empty And if I turn that into office space, which I could, I mean, you can renovate and turn it off. You can renovate anything and turn it into what you want. Mm-hmm. But I would have had to put elevators in all the buildings because of the ADA. Okay. And so at $500,000 a clip in 40 buildings, you know, that helped me make my case. You understand that I will have to renovate those and put in elevators in all the buildings. Mm-hmm. And they're like, why? Well, that's a little thing called the ADA. Yeah. And I got to do it. Well, how much will it cost? $20 million. What do you want me to tell you, you know? And so it's like, well, do you spend $20 million on old infrastructure just putting in an elevator, let alone new bathrooms, new walls, new offices, new, or just build a new one? That's how you make a case.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's interesting. It's interesting that, yeah, that the original business plan actually just sat down and...
Well, some things they just didn't... Well, there was so much to look at across the United States in BRAC that they didn't get everything straight. So that was clearly an oversight on their part. They really didn't think that I was going to need they really didn't think $17,000 was going to pay for it. It was an oversight.
Yeah.
But that was what the plan had in it. And but then you have to make the case. I mean, if it's in the plan, then the Army staff expects it's in the plan. You mm-hmm. you got to execute.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like, no, it doesn't work like that.
Revise the plan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Tony, do you have any more questions?
I've asked mine.
Do you have anything else?
No, I just thank you for the opportunity to do this. I'm glad to put some of it down in Kentucky history. I think it is an important step in Kentucky's history.
Absolutely.
You know, Fort Knox is part of Kentucky and a well-known part of Kentucky. If you, you know, watch Bugs Bunny, they talk about Fort mm-hmm. Knox. Watch anything and you'll hear, oh, it's as safe as Fort Knox, or Fort Knox is mentioned a lot of times.
It is.
And everybody knows where it is. It's in Kentucky. So it's a great part of Kentucky history. I think it's Kentucky Derby, Fort Knox, you know, that kind of brand name that is associated with Kentucky.
A lot of soldiers and their families have come through.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it's an enduring part of Kentucky, too. Horse racing might not be, but by God, they have Fort Knox. I don't know. I shouldn't have said that.
Well, it still is.
Yeah.
And I want it to stay.
And thank you for sharing the story, really. Thank you.
Oh, not a problem.
I really appreciate you taking the time.
Not a problem. Anytime.
Good. Okay. Well...